Shalom Nikulam. We're going to start the shiur now. Can people hear me? Excellent. Okay. So, good evening here in Israel. And we are actually around an hour or two away from Yom Yerushalayim, which this year, as you all know, is going to be celebrated a little bit differently than most years. People in Chutz Laaretz and in Israel today will feel very much the same when it comes to celebrating Yom Yerushalayim. We'll all be doing it from our homes. So with that special thought in our minds, I would like to begin our shiur today, which discusses keeping Shabbat in the state of Israel, and whether or not it's really possible to keep Shabbat on a state level, and what does that entail? So let's talk a little bit about the big question. The big question is it really possible to function in a modern state on Shabbat with keeping halacha? Meaning, you can say, of course it's possible, just stay at home and don't do anything. But as we mentioned before, a state, a country, cannot just look at every house as an individual. Rather, we are a state, we are a country, we are a nation, and we have to make sure that the public is safe. We have to make sure that we have an army, and we have a police, and we have an economy. And those type of offices, or government offices, or law services, or order, law and order services, have to function on a daily basis where it comes down to violating Shabbat. Is it really possible for us to have an army and a police that are able to keep Shabbat? I mentioned this question a little bit in the weeks ago in one of our first shiurim, but today I would like to go more into the practicality. I would like to suggest and offer different models that exist today of how we can keep Shabbat in the modern world. And what I'm going to do is like this. I'm going to start going through the different models that exist today in our world, in our private homes. We also have this dilemma today. How can we eat hot food on Shabbat? How can we have cold food on Shabbat? We are using electric appliances that, don't they also create a certain problem on Shabbat? How do we deal with those questions on our private domain? And we will go through these modern options of how to keep Shabbat in our homes. And then we will question whether or not we can use these existing models and use them on a state level. So let's go through some of the famous answers, responses, or that the rabbis and the Jewish law made up to help us keep Shabbat in areas that's not always so simple to do so. The first kind of a model will be using a non-Jew. Using a non-Jew, what we call in the old language Shabbos goy, that kind of model existed within the Jewish community a very long time ago, and it was used in situations where we really needed to violate Shabbat, and it really was a situation that was very, very difficult not to. So our rabbi suggested that we ask a non-Jew. Now, we know that this idea of using a non-Jew to solve halachic challenges, halachic problems, is not only in the world of Shabbat. We are aware that this exists also in selling chametz and in other areas. Shemitah today in Israel is sometimes used with this solution to solve the Shemitah problem. And even though it is a well-known solution, I think many of us don't really feel always comfortable by using this model. There's a famous story about the guy who wants to smoke. But he's aware that smoking is really against Jewish law. It's very dangerous. So he goes to a rabbi who, let's say, comes more from the Reform community. And she suggests to him that he can smoke, even though halachically it's not allowed. Of course, it's dangerous for your health. But there's a solution if you smoke outside your home, because the Jewish law only applies in your home. But the man really didn't like the solution. He thought that was a bit of a not a serious solution. He goes to the next rabbi who is more associated with the conservative community, and he asks the rabbi, is there any way he can smoke a cigarette? And the rabbi says, of course you shouldn't. It's against Jewish law. It's dangerous, but we have a solution for you. You can smoke on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays, because that's really half of the week. But the rest of the week, you really should not try. And he explains to him why. He didn't like that answer. What kind of joke is this? This day yes, this day not. Well, he didn't like it. So he goes to the Orthodox rabbi, and he says, Rabbi, I need a heter to smoke. Give me a heter. The rabbi says, well, of course, it's against halacha. But don't worry, we have found a solution for you. If you sell your lungs to a guy, you can continue smoking. So I think this story... I once told the story, by the way, to my good friend who was a Reform Jew, and he looked at me and he said, "Were you just making fun of Orthodoxy?" So I'm not making fun of anyone right now, but I think that the story does highlight that using this as a solution is very problematic for many reasons. A, even in cases where we really when the rabbi suggested to you the solution, it's not clear that this is really an ideal. I'll give you an example where this really came up, where this came up as a solution to solve a very serious problem in the Jewish history. It had to do with milking cows. As we know, milking a cow on Shabbat is prohibited, and milking cows on Shabbat involves breaking biblical violations. Maybe kotzer, tochein, dash. There are different suggestions what melacha is involved in milking cows. But everyone agrees that it's d'oraita. But we know that a cow that's not milked on Shabbat suffers greatly. And that's tzar balei chayim. And tzar balei chayim is a value that we take very seriously. It's not a value that would allow us to break Shabbat on a d'oraita level, but it would allow us on a d'rabanan level to break Shabbat. Asking a guy to break Shabbat for you is only Nisa de Rabbana. So the rabbi is permitted asking a non-Jew to milk a cow on Shabbat. When this was in Minhag, this was a custom, as already mentioned in Shulchan Aruch. And in the beginning of the 20th century, when the pioneers came to Israel and started building the land, and they faced this problem too, they were not very comfortable with it. And they turned to Rav Kook and they asked him for other options. Some people discuss about milking the milk into some food might be also not a d'oraita Easter. I'm not going to go into all the solutions that were suggested, but Rav Kook at the time made a statement that there's no problem using a non-Jew. It's a good solution. You should really use it, etc. Now, many people years later used this Rav Kook to prove that even Rav Kook, the great Zionist rabbi, was of the opinion that you should use this solution of a non-Jew to milk cows. However, it's really not fair to make that argument, because Rav Kook was talking in the 20s, in the beginning of there was no state, there was nothing else, there was no really other solutions, and we'll soon talk about other solutions that came up. Post the establishment of the State of Israel and kibbutzim today, who do not use non-Jews anymore, but use other methods of what to do on Shabbat. So the truth is that asking a guy to break Shabbat for you may be a solution in some places. I don't know if you are aware, but I'll give you an example. In some hospitals today in Israel, I think in Shaare Tzedek Hospital, if I'm not mistaken, till today, they have non-Jews working in the hospital on Shabbat, who walk around with the nurses, and they take the temperature of the patients, and they write things down. I know that there's usually someone on call outside the emergency room, that if someone drives up on Shabbat with a car, then they'll turn off your engine for you. They're instructed and they're trained to do things on Shabbat that would violate Shabbat. And there are certain institutions in Israel that really use this solution till today. Those of you who have traveled to Israel and went to hotels for Shabbat and Chagim know very well that the solution, right? I'm using that as the solution of using a non-Jew on Shabbat is used, I would say, a lot in the hotels and all around the country to on Shabbat and Yom Tov. So that is a solution that's used today. However, to use this solution to run a country is not a solution. Maybe a hospital here, or maybe a hotel there, but it's very difficult, for example, to use this model for the Israeli army. I'm saying that half jokingly. Can you imagine using non-Jews for the military? It would not be very, probably not a great idea. Maybe in the police force, it could be used partially, but I'm not very sure how practical this solution really is when it comes to run a whole country. But more than a practical question, there is a philosophical question here, I think, a principle, which is what I would like to talk about first. Meaning, are we saying that the only way that we can run a Jewish state is by bringing into the country or hiring non-Jews to run the country? As if HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us to build a Mamlechet Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us to build a country that would function by the Torah and the mitzvot would be our guidelines of how to run this country. Are we saying that the only way we can run a country is using non-Jews, turn on and off electricity, to drive people to the hospital, to take people's temperature, to heat up food on Shabbat in hotels? Is that what we're saying? If you look at the source sheet in front of you, that I have in front of you, hopefully you can see it now, you will see that this was pretty much a machloket between some Zionist rabbis years and years ago. Someone just wrote down, and I mentioned it then, I'll mention it again, about Professor Leibovitz's famous attack on the rabbinical world when he argued that the models that exist in Jewish law are not capable to deal with a Jewish state. At the time, Rav Neria, the founder of Bnei Akiva, in source number one, I'm not going to read it all inside, but he really believed, Rav Neria, that there is no reason why we cannot use non-Jews. He even somehow connected it to the idea that the state of Israel is a home for non-Jews as well as Jews. They are part of our society. They are part of the country. And we should not look down at a person who is a Shabbos goy. He says, if you follow me, Shabbat shel goy shel Shabbat eino dachlil. He says he's not a scarecrow. Ela ezrach mechubad b'medina. He's a respected citizen of the country that we should actually do'og lifarnasato la'asakato afilu b'sheshet imei ha'maaseh. Even during the rest of the week, we should provide and take care of them. I find this a very interesting attitude, because it really it does not just talk about the idea of the Shabbos goy. It really talks about the place of the non-Jewish community within the state of Israel and how we should really take care of them and provide them. And maybe if the non-Jewish communities in Israel would be working on Shabbat in the hospitals, in the in the hotels, then really that's an ideal of somehow bringing them into the workforce and taking care of them. It's a very interesting angle. However, at the time, Rav Goren, Chief Rabbi Goren, attacked this position and really made a statement here, which goes back to what I said before, that his statement really questioned, how is it possible that the Torah, at the same time that it commands us to build a society, a Jewish state, is telling us that the only way we could do it is by using non-Jews. Therefore, Rav Goren, from a principle point of view, argues we must find other suggestions, other models to solve these problems that have to do with running a state on Shabbat. Now, what are those suggestions? I'm not going to that right now, but it's a very interesting point that Rav Goren makes here, that he truly believes that we have to look into the Torah and look for new ideas of how to run a Jewish state, because he cannot comprehend the possibility that that we have to use non-Jews. Now, by the way, as we'll soon see, Rav Goren made this argument not only about using non-Jews to work, he used the same argument for us not relying on other areas that would require us to bring from Chutz La'aretz certain things that we need to keep a country. I'll give you one very, very extreme example that Rav Goren at the time was also adamant about, and that had to do with creating a bank of skin, a skin bank. As we know, after the wars, after the Kippur War, many boys were burnt and needed skin grafts. And Israel doesn't keep any skin of dead bodies, because we are very, very careful of nivul hamet. We're very careful to bury bodies right away. And at the time, there was just not enough skin for these boys, for these soldiers. And Israel had to actually go out in the world and buy from other places. And at the time, the suggestion came up to prepare for Chas V'Shalom, the next war. Even if we don't know if there'll be a war, it's our responsibility to make sure that somewhere there are, and it's a terrible thought to but it's a very practical, pragmatic idea to prepare for the future, that if in the time of need, in the time of war, we'll need skin, then we should have it frozen somewhere and for time of need. And Rav Goren made the same argument. He said, it cannot be that the only solution for this would be to rely on buying non-Jewish skin. He said, if the Torah wants us to live here and to function as a state, then we must make it possible to set aside skin for such a purpose. And the same argument, by the way, he made for using bodies for medical students. Israel for many years used to buy abroad bodies for learning medicine. And again, Rav Goren came along and said, I don't understand. We have to learn medicine because we have to have doctors, we have to have hospitals, we have to take care of people. And therefore, it must be that we can find within the Torah and the Halakha a solution of how we can use Jewish bodies for learning medicine. So the principle of Rav Goren is all the same here. It comes from an understanding that if the Torah commands us to build a Jewish state, we cannot assume that the Torah said that the only way to do that is to rely on non-Jews. So, as I said, the first solution that we discussed, that's a very practical one and used till today, not only in Chutz La'aretz, but even in Israel, using non-Jews, is not necessarily a great solution for an entire state. Let's move on to other models, other solutions that came up in Jewish history of how we can work with Shabbat. By the way, those of you who are not in Israel right now, just sharing with you that in Israel right now, it's very hot. If I'm not mistaken, just like in Canada, we also measure temperature by Celsius. Is that correct? So if you want to know how hot it is, the joke going around Israel right now is that you're not allowed to say the temperature right now, because then you wouldn't be able to count Sfirat HaOmer tonight with a bracha. And that just gives you an idea of how hot it is outside. It's in the 40s, it's pretty. It's really pretty hot right now in this country. Okay, another suggestion, which a more modern solution to keep Shabbat in our modern homes today is the idea of the Shabbos clock. All right, we want to have on Shabbat our air conditioning going off and on. We want our fans to go on and off. We want our Shabbos plata to go on and off. So they invented the Shabbos clock. Is the Shabbos clock also a solution of running a Jewish state? Could we also use in factories and in police force? Is that a really practical solution of using violating so-called Shabbat and allowing things to run by using a Shabbos clock? So I'll just say Shabbos clock is a very big discussion halacha. I'm not going to go to all the ins and outs of a Shabbos clock. I remember when I used to be a rabbi in London, and I remember that they used to have the caretaker of the shul plug in the Shabbos plata every morning to heat up the kugel and the challenge for the kiddush. And coming from Israel, where I hesitate to use non-Jews so quickly, I suggested that we buy a Shabbos clock and put the hot plate on a Shabbos clock. Now, using a Shabbos clock is probably better halachically than using a non-Jew. Using a non-Jew is still an Isur Derabana, but using a Shabbos clock, it theoretically is no violation whatsoever. Now, I say that whatsoever because not every posek was so excited about the Shabbos clock, and I'll explain. What could be the problem of using a Shabbos clock? So there's a famous machloket in Masechet Shabbat between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel regarding Shvitat Kelim. We know that on Shabbat we have to rest, we're not allowed to work. Not only are we not allowed to work, but our animals are not allowed to work. What about our vessels? Are our vessels allowed to work for us? That's a machloket by Beit Shammai to Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai thinks that even on Shabbat, your vessels should not be working for you. The Gemara brings some examples of, let's say, crushing your olives before Shabbat on a vessel that crushes olives, and throughout the Shabbat, the olives are being crushed, turning into oil. Is that permitted? So I'm not going to go into the whole machloket. We paskin like Beit Hillel that there's no problem of your vessels working for you on Shabbat unless they're making a noise. If they make a noise, then we are not so keen of that, because we are concerned that people walking by will think that you are working on Shabbat. Let's say you have a mill that's working on Shabbat by itself, but people hearing the noise of the mill might think that you are breaking Shabbat, and therefore the Ramah is more machmir, and the Ramah says that you should not have your vessels working for your Shabbat if it makes noise. The Shulchan Aruch is more meikel. There is a really interesting tshuva. I'll just give you an example of a modern tshuva that comes up in this context. Rav Avadia Yosef has a tshuva in which he discusses an Israeli soldier coming home right before Shabbat and has to leave right after Shabbat. Can you throw his clothes in the washing machine right before Shabbat, and the washing machine will be working on Shabbat, even though you turned it on before? Are you allowed to do such a thing, or put him in the dryer? So Rav Avadia is very lenient because he goes by Shulchan Aruch. He says our brothers, the Ashkenazim, might be a bit more hesitant to do such a thing because a washing machine makes noise, and the Ramah is more machmir about using making noise on Shabbat. If it's really a great need, as it is in this case, there's room to be lenient. By the way, this question, it has to do with using dishwashers on Shabbos clocks. It has to do even with putting our fans and air conditionings today We are usually much more lenient today. And one of the reasons is because it's become such a custom, a well-known custom, to put on even dishwashers or fans and air conditioners on a Shabbos clock, and no one walking by suspects that you have done it yourself. Therefore, today we're much more lenient. What is fascinating about this discussion is that one of the greatest poskim of North America of the 20th century, Rav Moshe Feinstein, was very much against using Shabbos clocks. At the time, he permitted using a Shabbos clock for lights, because he argued that lights are so, the custom is so spread that people use Shabbos lights, a Shabbos clock for lights, that they're not even, no one suspects that you turn on the light. However, his concern is that if we start putting all our machines on Shabbos clocks, he said the next step is that our factories will be working on a Shabbos clock. And he said that that would really destroy the spirit of Shabbat. Rav Moshe says that what is the original reason that it's prohibited to use a non-Jew on Shabbat to do malacha for you? As I mentioned before, there is no way, you're not allowed to use the Shabbos goy for anything on Shabbat. For only very, very specific reasons you're allowed to ask a non-Jew to violate Shabbat for you. Why not, says Rav Moshe? Because if it would be permitted to use a non-Jew to do everything for you on Shabbat, then it wouldn't be Shabbat. It would be a regular day. You would tell the non-Jew, please write a letter for me. Please sign this check for me. Please do this business deal for me. Please turn on the fridge. Please turn on the oven. Please cook for me. Please do this. Please do that. And Shabbat would be like a regular day. Therefore, Moshe Feinstein argued that if the rabbis of at the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara would be alive today, he said they would also prohibit Shabbos clocks for the same reason they prohibited using a non-Jew on Shabbat. What's fascinating about that is that Rav Moshe didn't really win. I have a friend or two that really follow Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he told me that in some communities in North America, some people that really were followers of Moshe Feinstein really do hesitate to use Shabbos clocks today. I was a bit surprised. I wasn't aware of that, because I think that in Israel, it's very well, it's a common thing to use the Shabbos clock. And if I'm not mistaken, in North America, I assume it's the same. I think it's a great example where sometimes the people decide as if what is done, and the Shomrei Shabbat community de facto has followed other opinions, and not Rav Moshe's opinion about this. You know, Rav Moshe Feinstein, like many poskim, sometimes win, sometimes they don't. I'm sure people know that in the Orthodox community, no one today, to my knowledge, I'm afraid to say no one, but I think the minhag today in North America for sure, but also in Israel, is not to use peanuts in the Ashkenazi community. Rav Moshe Feinstein thought you were allowed to. So sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. It doesn't always you don't always win all the psaks. So Shabbos clock is probably a better solution than asking a non-Jew. And probably if hotels, for example, or institutions like yeshivot and schools, maybe even hospitals, could use Shabbos clocks, it's probably a better solution halachically than using a non-Jew. However, I'm sure we understand that it's almost impossible to run hospitals or fire departments or police or the army with a Shabbos clock. Really difficult when you have a certain routine. Obviously, I'm not talking about pikuach nefesh. I'm talking about a certain routine that you can never measure by the minute, or that every half an hour, it depends upon patients, for example, coming in, right? So it's very hard, I think, to practically use the model of the Shabbos clocks to run a country. The third model that exists today in Israel to, again, solve the challenges of Shabbat is Grama. Grumma is a very huge topic. It's a term, it's a phrase that is found in the Gemara and has, I'm sure people are aware that Machon Somet here in Alon Shvut, the institution of combining Jewish law and technology founded here and down the road from me in Alon Shvut, founded by Rav Rosen. Some of you know Rav Uri Dasberg, who was on Shlichut with my parents in Toronto many, many years ago. Both of them, Aleihem Shalom. This institution has used the phrase, the concept of grama to really try to solve major halachic problems in hospitals, in the army, in the police. And we'll talk a few minutes about the idea of grama. What is grama? Grama means indirect. On Shabbat, we are not allowed to break Shabbat in a direct fashion, right? We can't, for example, write letters on a piece of paper on Shabbat. We are not allowed to put out a fire, for example, on Shabbat, if it's not a dangerous fire. We're not allowed to build a building on Shabbat, etc. However, if the action is done in a non-direct fashion, the Gemara permits, in great need, to perform the act, again, if it's non-direct. Now, what does non-direct mean? This is very complicated, and it's really out of the realm of our discussion right now. I'm going to share with you right now, as you can see in the source sheet, in source number 3, and I'm going to post this source sheet for you afterwards on the website of Torah in Motion. You can all look at it. But in source number 3, I quoted here a summary of Rabbi Broid and Rabbi Jachter, well-known modern Orthodox rabbis who wrote about this and tried to explain the concept of grama, of indirect. What does that mean? I'll just bring one example that the Gemara brings, the example of extinguishing a fire on Shabbat. I just mentioned that on Shabbat, you're not allowed to extinguish a fire, of course, if it's not a dangerous fire, right? Today, every fire is dangerous, and I'm not talking about that. But in the times of the Gemara, they were talking about situations in which, let's say there's a fire, and all that's going to be burned is a house, for example, and what's going to be lost is just a financial loss. In that case, you're not allowed to extinguish the fire, but financial loss is a serious thing. So the Gemara suggests that we extinguish the fire in a grama fashion. How would that be? How can you do that? The Gemara suggests building a wall made out of clay buckets that have in them water. Building a wall of buckets in front of the fire. And when the fire reaches the buckets, it'll surround the clay buckets, which will burst from the heat, and the water will extinguish the fire. That's considered a grama, an indirect. The question is, what does indirect really mean? Some people argue that it's a delay of time. If you have a delay between your action and the result, that's a grama. Some people argue that if it's not a sure thing that it will happen, that's also a grama. So what is a grama exactly and how does it work? That's a discussion of itself for another time. But in Machon Somet, they, using the tshuvot of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, they argued that this is a great model in which we can solve halachic challenges here in the state of Israel. So for example, people are probably aware that they made the gramophone for doctors, arguing that using a phone on Shabbat is prohibited, but a doctor needs a phone. But not every phone call is pikuach nefesh, right? A doctor can get a phone call that's not pikuach. How will he know? So you're right. If you don't know, pick up the phone. But let's say I can build you a phone that will not violate Shabbat and will be a grama and a derabanan iser. Isn't that better? So they created the grama phone. How does that work exactly? I'm not going to go into that right now. They also created the grama pen, a pen that the writing doesn't exist more than 24 hours, what we call a disappearing ink, right? So here again, using the idea that only writing that will remain intact forever is violating Shabbat on a biblical level, they invented the pen that would disappear after a few hours arguing that that kind of pen could be used in the army, could be used in the police, et cetera, et cetera. They even invented, believe it or not, they build a Grumma Jeep for security reasons. It wasn't really useful. I don't think it was really, but they did. They played with this invention of building a Grumma Jeep, which driving this car on Shabbat would not violate any biblical transgressions. It would be completely a derabbanon. You would only be breaking derabbanons by driving this Jeep. So I don't know if you're aware, by the way, but in Israel yesterday, they announced that the shuls can open. But one of the big problems that came up is that one of the only ways to open the shuls is that there has to be someone at the entrance taking people's temperature and assuring that no one has a temperature. So, of course, people start discussing what can you do on Shabbat. Is it taking a temperature with an old-fashioned thermometer? There's no problem, but using technology, using a modern thermometer might be a problem on Shabbat. So Machon Somet, it came out this week in the news, they build a Shabbos Grumma thermometer that would be at the entrance of the shul, and every person coming into the shul would walk by, and no Shabbat violation would occur by this thermometer Grumma. I don't know what they call it yet. I don't know if there's a name yet, the Grumma thermometer. But by the way, a similar idea was also created. For those of you who go to the Kotel on Shabbat, you might know that some people, you have to go through a metal detector, and the metal detector is supposed to detect metal, and it's supposed to go off if you have some metal on you, which some from people said, I can't go through a metal detector on Shabbat because it creates a violation of Shabbat if I have some metal on me. So again, Machon Somet, again, I'm not going to explain the ins and outs, but they invented a Shabbos metal detector that is, by the way, used right as we speak. It's used at the entrance of the Kotel. And on Shabbat, you're allowed to walk through it without any problem. It doesn't violate Shabbat. So Machon Somet really, really used this idea of Grumma. By the way, one of the most important solutions that they used with the Grumma was milking cows on Shabbat. I said before that for many years in Israel, they used to use non-Jews to milk the cows, but they invented Grumma milking machines, which milk the cows using a machine that if you press the button of the milking machine, there is a time in between when you press the button until the pumps actually work, which according to the idea of Grumma would mean that you're milking a cow on Shabbat, but only breaking Shabbat derabanan and not de'oraita. And because the cow is suffering, you're allowed to do so on Shabbat. This created a big argument amongst rabbis. Wait a second, what's better, using a non-Jew or using the Grumma method? I'm not gonna go into this discussion. There are articles about this and shuvas about this. The religious Zionist rabbis like Rav Ariel and others argued that they believe that the Grumma is a better solution than using a non-Jew. And according to what we mentioned before, the argument of Rav Goren, I think also adds to this argument that using a non-Jew should only be the last resort. But if we can find within technology, we can find a way to run a modern country using technology and halacha, that is preferable. So that's really a preferred model that exists today. So until now, we spoke about three existing solutions that some of us use in our own private homes when it comes to dealing with keeping Shabbat in the modern times, using a non-Jew, a Sha'on Shabbat, Shabbat's clock, and Grumma. However, I believe that the main issue in front of us is not necessarily just the solution, but as I spoke about the last few weeks, it's about the mindset that we come to the table dealing with running a Jewish state. And that has to do with the definition of pikuach nefesh. What is the definition of violating Shabbat for pikuach nefesh? Here, I think the big argument exists within the religious community here in Israel, how to define pikuach nefesh in the past and in the present. I already spoke about this a few weeks ago, that the normative psak, which was accepted in Europe for hundreds of years, was that pikuach nefesh allows us to break Shabbat only if the situation in front of us is a clear pikuach nefesh situation. The famous case that was discussed by the Noda Yehuda in Prague, Rabbi Cheskel Landau in the 18th century, was we have someone who died, and we think, the doctors suggest, that if we do an autopsy, we'll be able in the future to save lives, was not a good enough reason for him to violate an autopsy, which halachically is problematic, because the pikuach nefesh is not directly in front of us. If we have a patient in front of us that is dangerously sick, and we think that by doing an autopsy, we can save the other person's life who is in danger right now, then he would permit it. But if you're just thinking about the future, that is not considered a pikuach nefesh. So first of all, many religious Zionist rabbis argued, especially Rav Gorin and others, that a state cannot allow itself to think the same way in those kind of terms. A state must take into account that pikuach nefesh situation, if not happening right now, will happen in minutes, in hours, will happen tomorrow. We cannot look at the situation in front of us, even if it's not this second, as if it's not a pikuach nefesh situation. We must look at the reality in front of us as if at any given time there are people that are dangerous in front of us. And therefore, if we need to violate certain violations to preserve life, even if it's not in front of us, we should take that into account. So first of all, the whole idea of how we view pikuach nefesh now or in the future has changed a lot when we view the halachot regarding keeping a Jewish state safe. This, by the way, is not just in the case that we just discussed now about learning medicine or performing autopsies, but this case is already found in the Gemara and the Rambam regarding saving people on Shabbat. And here is a principle which, again, can be used today to understand what is pikuach nefesh. The Gemara tells us that if the Jewish community that's in danger, we must go out and help the Jewish community. If robbers come to attack a community, we must go out and fight them. The question is, after the battle is finished, after everything is over, can the people that came to help the Jewish community, are they allowed to go back to where they came from? Are they allowed to carry their rifles or whatever it is, their equipment, back to where they left to come to save this community? And the Rambam, based upon the Gemara, permits returning, violating Shabbat, even though there is no pikuach nefesh. It's all over. It's finished. The people are saved. Why are you allowed to drive back on Shabbat? People might be familiar with this halacha regarding doctors, nurses that go to a hospital on Shabbat based upon pikuach nefesh and are allowed to return. Why are they allowed to return? They theoretically, they should be stranded in the hospital for the rest of the Shabbat. There's no pikuach nefesh anymore. The answer is that the pikuach nefesh of the future has to be taken into account when it comes to these situations. Because as Gemara explains, if we don't allow the doctors, the policemen, the firemen to return to where they came from on Shabbat, in the future, they will not leave their homes if they know that they'll be stuck in the place that they had to travel to. Meaning, if you think about what that means that the reason why we allow you to violate Shabbat today is because in the future, there might be a pikuach nefesh situation next week. And that didn't even happen yet. And yet, because we're worried that if we don't allow you to go home today, next week when we call you, you won't be willing to travel on Shabbat to save someone's life. Because of that situation, we already now today allow you to violate Shabbat. Here is a good case in which one could argue that we have a model that exists already, that pikuach nefesh is taken into account, even if it's not in front of us right now. So, as I said, one important discussion before us is really the idea of pikuach nefesh. Is it in front of us or is it in the future? That is something that I think the past 50, 60, 70 years have been taken into account. And the definition of a pikuach nefesh situation in front of us or not in front of us has really changed the whole attitude of how we treat the idea of pikuach nefesh. Secondly, the second mindset change, I believe, is understanding that there's a difference between the pikuach nefesh of the individual and of the community. Here again, I would like to go back to the source sheet. And if you look at the source sheet, you will see that there's a Gemara. I'm sorry, I'm just going down the sheet. There are a lot of sources here today, and I'm happy people later on want to go through them. In source number 8, you will see that Shmuel says the following: Mechabin b'chelet shematechet b'rishut harabim. It is permitted to extinguish a coal, I think that would be the correct translation, of metal in the public domain, bishvil shelo yazuku b'rabim, in order for the rabim, the public, thank you, the public domain will not be endangered. The question is Shmuel permitting violating Shabbat on a biblical level or on the rabbinical level? So the Rishonim argue about this question in source number 9 and suggest different possibilities. Some Rishonim, however, really understand that he permitted to break Shabbat, to extinguish a burning coal. If you follow with me now with what I'm highlighting, V'teimahu, says the Ramban, Ech anu matirim melacha gmura mishum hezek, shelo bimkom safek nefeshot, meaning if it would be a direct danger, of course you'll have to extinguish something on Shabbat. But the situation in front of us is not a direct pikuach nefesh situation, and yet Shmuel permitted to violate Shabbat. Answers the Ramban, V'shema kol hezek shel rabim, perhaps any damage to the public is considered sakanat nefashot. Meaning, usually in the private domain, we require a direct pikuach nefesh situation before us in order for us to allow, to permit to violate Shabbat. However, Shmuel says, when it comes to the public domain, way before we reach a situation of a direct pikuach nefesh, even a damage that might harm the public is looked upon in the beginning already as a pikuach nefesh. I'll give you an example where we can really use this principle. And by the way, Rav Yisraeli used this principle in to allow the police to work on Shabbat. I'll give you an example. Let's say someone broke into your home and you come home and you found your house on Shabbat, it was broken in, some things were taken, and it's clear that they're not there anymore. There's no danger anymore. No one is threatening you. Theoretically, one could argue there's no reason to call the police. It can wait. Someone say Shabbat, insurance reasons, whatever. You can call, you can wait. Someone say Shabbat. Is there any reason, A, for you to break Shabbat to call the police? But more important for me is, I'm the policeman. I get the phone call. Should I, on Shabbat, drive a car to the house and investigate where it's clear that there's no danger? Rav Yisraeli uses our source to argue that a country, a state, a government cannot allow a situation in which robbers will feel that they can go rob houses because there'll be no response. And even if it's not a direct pikuach nefesh this moment, but of course, having a situation in which a country will be, there'll be no law and order, having anarchy, is of course a situation that will lead to pikuach nefesh. So way before that, even on the level of damages, which is not right now in front of us, pikuach nefesh, says Rabbi Israeli, that itself is considered on a state level as a pikuach nefesh. So what we did today is we questioned whether or not it's really possible to run a country in modern times when one is required to violate Shabbat. We suggested three or four different models that exist in our private domains, and we discussed the possibility of adapting them to the public domain using a non-Jew, what we call it Shabbos goy, using Shabbos clocks, or using grumma. I suggested, based upon Machon Somet, that really grumma is probably one of the better solutions to be using today. It can solve a lot of problems. However, at the end of the shiur, we argued that re-looking and re-understanding the concept of pikuach nefesh as it was in the past and today on the level state can also help us define situations which maybe in the past would not be considered pikuach nefesh and therefore would not allow us to violate Shabbat. Today might be considered pikuach nefesh, which would allow us to break Shabbat directly, immediately, rather than to rely on all the other heterim that we used in the past. So either using models that exist or, and together, not or, and using the rethinking about the definitions of pikuach nefesh in modern times and running a state, both together, these two ideas, I think, could help us run a country. And I think that we're still going through the journey of figuring it out. But Baruch Hashem, many of these solutions and models are being implemented today in the state of Israel. And I think that more and more suggested solutions are out there today, allowing us, Baruch Hashem, to run a Jewish state based upon keeping halakha and allowing us to keep halakha and at the same time running a Jewish state. Thank you very much, everyone. I hope we learned something today about how to run a Jewish state based upon Jewish law. And I hope to see you soon. Have a Chag Sameach tonight for Chag Yom Yerushalayim. Leitraot.
Can I answer the chat question?
Yes, so the chat. Let's look at the chats. There are just so many. There are a few of them. I'm just going up and down. Was there a specific question that you wanted to ask? Because I see a lot of...
Where do you draw the line about Shabbos clocks? Can you use it, for example, to turn a radio on or off?
Right. So a radio is more problematic because a radio is really a noise. And that creates, there's the issue of avshamilta. There's another issue of not listening to noise on Shabbat. And I would say that the bigger problem of radio on Shabbat would be what we call the spirit of Shabbat, which should really be violated. Meaning using a dishwasher on Shabbat to wash dishes, one can argue, is really there to help us have an oneg Shabbat. It's very difficult to argue the same about using listening to a radio, which would be an issue of uvdin dechol and creating a non-Shabbat atmosphere. Besides that, but the Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a tshuva specifically about radios, and he really prohibits using radios for these and other reasons on Shabbat. I agree with you, though, that it's a very good question. The where do you draw the line is not always so clear. And I agree with you. I know that some people are hesitate about using dishwashers on Shabbat on a Shabbos clock because of these reasons, and it's not so clear. I can tell you that I think time will tell what will be accepted and what won't be accepted. I believe that there's a lot of power in what people actually do and what's accepted. And it could be that in 20, 30 years from now, we'll look back and we'll see this is allowed, this is not allowed based upon what people actually do. I believe that's part of the Masorah. Masorah is not just created by opinions of rabbis, it's also many times de facto done by the people. So that's another discussion of itself. But that is a good question, where you draw the line.